community is because India and China are on Russia's side, and that's about almost 3 billion people, or half the world. So when people in the West say international community, they usually mean U.S., Canada, and some Western European countries, which is clearly not an international community. And if you look, many African countries are supporting Russia too. So that's another thing. And because the U.S. has been posturing and has been trying to actually to weaken Russia in many ways since the 1990s, it is well within Russia's duty to protect its sovereignty.
Okay.
Sovereignty, and therefore it will be more aggressive. And we cannot call the war in Ukraine unprovoked, because we know that the U.S. has been arming some of the worst people, like the Azov Battalion, etc., for the past 8 years, and
sorry to
right
jump
at
in there.
Russia's border.
Okay. Yeah, we're out of time for tonight. Thanks to Mr. Andrei Doriansky joining us from New York, and thanks to Esha Krishnaswamy speaking to us from St. Petersburg. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'dhin wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم. فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم. فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Ukraine says Russian troops have temporarily eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut to regroup and to strengthen their capabilities. Tens of thousands of Serbs have taken to the streets of Belgrade in an anti-government protest triggered by two mass shootings that killed 18 people. Also in the headlines, people once again rally in Tel Aviv to protest against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mnis. Thanks for joining us. Russia says its forces have taken full control of the eastern Ukrainian city of Bakhmut and have now temporarily eased attacks to regroup and strengthen their capabilities. We discussed the recent developments in our news review program.
And I welcome everyone to the news review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Ukraine says Russian troops have temporarily eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut to regroup and strengthen their capabilities. Now, Russia says its forces have completely taken over the city, but Kiev says it still controls pockets of Bakhmut. Battle for the city has been the longest and bloodiest of the war. Capture will bring Russia slightly closer to its goal of controlling the entire region of Donetsk. Meanwhile, Ukraine says it will soon launch a highly anticipated counteroffensive. Ukrainian defense officials said the push could start as soon as tomorrow or ultimately by the end of the week. Ukraine says the offensive aims to recapture territory taken by Russia since start of the war. Joining us now for the program is Matthew Everett, a senior fellow at American University in Moscow, joining us out of Montreal, and Christopher Helali, researcher and political analyst, joining us out of Verchères, Vermont. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program now. I guess we'll start there in Vermont with you, Christopher. Hope you're safe and doing well. Your initial thoughts on this thing becoming protracted. We had one of Vladimir Putin's top aides saying this thing could possibly be drawn out. decades maybe even. I mean, if this thing is protracted, tell us some of your thoughts on the ramifications involved, especially for the Europeans.
The ramifications are enormous, and this is what was revealed in the recent leaks on Discord from the young man Teixeira, who shared top secret intelligence from the United States and Western allies that mentioned that this is going to become a protracted conflict, that there is no easy path and solution. And of course, at the same time, you have the Russian foreign ministry, saying to the Ukrainians that there are some ways that we can achieve a settlement, and those include, for example, having Russian as a language, recognizing the rights of minorities, recognizing the new geopolitical situation and border situation, as well as not joining the EU and NATO. But of course, the Ukrainians want to protract the war because that's what their Western backers are pushing for. So there, you have to imagine that there are thousands of shipments of arms going daily from many, many NATO countries and their allies to Ukraine to continue to do this. And we recently heard from Lindsey Graham in a meeting with Zelensky saying it's a good thing that Russians are dying and that's what we're paying for. So it looks like the Russians are willing to go to the negotiating table. The Ukrainians are not, and they're willing to destroy their entire country and have their people sacrifice on the altar of war to further Western aims. So I see a long protracted war that we're entering that phase at this point, and I see a lot of devastation in the future because the West simply does not want to negotiate and recognize concerns.
And thank you, Christopher, there. Matthew, welcome to the program. Now, Matthew, we're seeing the West slowly starting to get more and more sophisticated in the kind of weapons they're giving the Ukrainians. There's talk of F-16s now. You very well know every time we hear about missiles being given to the Kiev forces, we're hearing about missiles that could hit longer ranges. Possibly now there's talk of 500-kilometer missiles that could hit inside of Russian territory. Is this thing, in your point of view, going to blow into something that's going to involve more than just Russia and Ukraine, ultimately?
Well, that is the tightrope that is being walked right now. And as you pointed out, these 500-kilometer range missiles that are being proposed from the German side, the Taurus projectiles, do bring Moscow into striking distance. The F-16s, these would be equipped on F-16s. There's other missiles like Storm Shadows that have been supplied by UK. In most of these cases so far, we've seen Russia handle it pretty well. And I mean, the Storm Shadows recently were shot down by Russian defenses very effectively. And Mark Milley even had to make a point. And Mark Milley is no representative of sanity by any measure. But even Milley himself had to state that the F-16s would be completely useless when dealing with the thousands of fourth and fifth generation Russian fighters capable of outmaneuvering them a thousand ways from Sunday. So, I mean, on the one hand, Russia has a very, very high level capacity to respond to many of the best technologies that are being put forth from the United States and from the broader collective West. At the same time, the Kiev regime is run as a puppet regime, and unfortunately, some of these puppets are basket cases, many of them are, who have all openly stated their desires not only to join NATO, but also to host nuclear warheads that would be owned by the United States. This is what Zelensky openly stated a week before the military intervention began last year. So obviously, yeah, this could derail, this could snowball in a variety of ways, similarly as we'd seen in World War I, which nobody expected, except in World War I there were no nuclear warhead technologies.
Thank you both for joining us on the program. Matthew Everett there joining us out of Montreal, and Christopher Helali joining us from Vershaw, Vermont. Thank you for tuning in. That's it for this segment of your news review program, and bye-bye for now.
Tens of thousands of Serbs have taken to the streets of Belgrade in an anti-government protest over two mass shootings that have killed 18 people. The crowd surrounded a compound housing the state broadcaster, calling for the resignation of the Serbian president. They also demanded more media freedom. This was the fourth such protest organized by opposition parties. They blamed the government of failing to rein in media that have promoted violence and to act against criminal elements in society. The government denies opposition parties' allegations, accusing them of staging protests for political gain. On May the 3rd, a young boy killed 9 students and a security guard in Belgrade in the first school mass shooting in Serbia. One day later, a 21-year-old man killed 8 others outside of the city. French police brutality against protesters continues to occur, and one group which knows plenty about that subject are the Yellow Vest anti-government protesters. They still gather every Saturday nationwide and do so despite regular harassment by police and judges. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's Yellow Vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the Yellow Vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries. The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a Yellow Vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy is why the Yellow Vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, the Yellow Vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Iran's president has warned the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries against some Western government's attempts to sow discord among its member states. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks during a meeting with OPEC Secretary General Haytham Al-Rais in Tehran. Raisi said OPEC member states should work to promote unity within the organization to foil such plots. He added that Iran is ready to uplift cooperation with the organization, expressing hope that OPEC will be able to control the oil market's volatility in the coming months. Meanwhile, Al-Rais hailed Iran for its constructive cooperation with the organization, saying that Tehran has always worked to foster unity among other OPEC members. He noted that unity within the organization will bring calm to the market. Tens of thousands of people have yet again, for the fifth month, flocked the streets of Tel Aviv protesting against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial overhaul. The consecutive weekly protests have seen some success in that the plan has not been approved as quickly as Netanyahu had hoped for. But it seems that the Prime Minister and his far-right cabinet remain committed to push through the changes, despite being under immense pressure both at home and abroad to scrap the plan. Netanyahu agreed to delay the overhaul to try to negotiate with the opposition a middle ground. But after shifting focus to pass the annual budget last week, the highly contested plan is again at the forefront. Economists have warned that an independent court system is crucial, that the plan would further isolate the Israeli regime internationally.
And two more activists, Richard Becker, joined us earlier and told us why Netanyahu's far-right cabinet is so adamant to push through the plan and what the protesters must do for any real change.
If they do not go through with the plan, if the plan does not pass, if it's not ratified by the Knesset, the parliament, then the coalition government that presently exists will collapse. This extreme right-wing government that has actual fascists in it is built on the idea that they can go forward with plans to annex the West Bank and other territories as well and dispossess more of the Palestinian population. But again, the big problem here is that today, in what was the British Mandate or colony of Palestine, the Palestinian population and the Israeli population are about the same. The Palestinian population is probably a little bigger. But whether they live in West Bank or they live in Gaza or they live inside the 1948 borders of Israel, all in different forms, but all of this Palestinian population suffers under a form of apartheid. And as for long as that issue is not addressed, and so far the protests have not addressed that and have avoided it and even suppressed people with Palestinian flags coming to the demonstrations. Unless that changes, I don't think there can be any real change in the state of it.
The Turkish presidential candidates have wrapped up their campaigns ahead of a runoff to be held on Sunday. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan urged people to vote in a way that could allow the legislature and executive to work together. Erdogan also questioned his rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu's ability to function without a parliamentary majority if he wins. Kılıçdaroğlu, meanwhile, addressed supporters in Istanbul and touched on what he called serious economic problems. He also said the situation is not bright in Turkey. The economy is a major issue for voters, as inflation has soared in the past couple of years, triggering a cost-of-living crisis. The Turkish lira has greatly lost its value as well. On Friday, it plunged to a record low of 20 against the U.S. dollar. The correspondent in Istanbul, Rashan Sagalam, joined us earlier to give the details on how the Turkish presidential runoff is going to be held while offering an insight on what's going on inside the minds of first-time voters.
Well, we will open the ballots at 8 a.m. It will close at 5 p.m. At 6, the ballots will be gathered. At 7, the counting will start. At 9, we are going to start seeing hearing numbers. And at 12 midnight, we should have the approximate result if there was no need to hide the results for security reasons, because everyone in the country is saying that the situation this time is a little bit more tense and the government does not want any problem to be happening. So they might delay the results until the next morning. More than 64 million Turkish citizens will be casting their votes. And in the previous elections, we saw some 6 million from the youth casting their votes for the first time. And they were very excited about that because most of them wanted to see a change in the country. Now, for the past 2 weeks, we have been seeing them both campaigning very hard to try and harvest the undecided votes. We have some undecided votes, and we have the votes that went to Sinan Ogan, the third presidential candidate, who is not going to be in the runoff now. This election is really important for Turkey because of the economic situation that the country is going through. We are facing the worst crisis in the cost of living in the country. The lira for the first time is 20 against the US dollars. The two candidates, they're both promising better economy, better economic strategies. They're both promising to lower the inflation rate. They're both promising the people a better future.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
the supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans, and I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
The biggest economy in Europe is facing zero growth. A new study has found that energy and raw materials prices, along with a shortage of skilled workers, pose major threats to the German economy. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Bloomberg reported the German business community has little optimism about growth prospects in the EU's largest economy, citing a study conducted by the Association of German Chambers of Industry and Commerce, DIHK. After two quarters of zero growth, respondents from 21,000 companies that took part in the survey said there were little signs of improvement in the economic environment. Despite the resilience that German companies have shown during the month of soaring energy prices and rising interest rates, the outlook for the next 12 months remains murky, especially since incoming orders are noticeably decreasing on the demand side, DIHK CEO Ilja Nottangel said in a statement. Researchers at the DIHK maintained a forecast of zero growth in Germany this year, although more pessimistic than 0.2% expansion expected by the European Commission, it matches a recent outlook put out by the International Monetary Fund. Last week, IMF issued a forecast saying German GDP growth will stay near zero in 2023 before gradually strengthening to 1% to 2% during 2024 to 2026 as the lagged effects of monetary tightening gradually dissipate and the economy adjusts to the energy shock. Economists are predicting that German industry will remain at a standstill instead of the hoped-for recovery, dampening prospects of an economic resurgence. The DIHK survey has highlighted prices of energy and raw materials as the biggest threat facing German businesses, while a lack of qualified workers was seen as a major structural challenge for companies in the future. Also, RT noted, inflation in the euro area increased for the first time in 5 months in April, surging to 7%. The European Union's Statistics Office reported recently, confirming preliminary data. Eurostat said consumer prices had risen from 6.9% in March, as higher services and energy costs offset a slowdown in food price growth. Services inflation, which is primarily driven by labor costs, accelerated to 5.2% in April from 5.1% in the previous month. Energy prices were up again after a slight decline in March. Food, tobacco prices were also up by 2.75% last month, but were lower than 3.12% rise in March. According to the report, core inflation, excluding food and energy prices, slowed to 7.3% from 7.5%, while an even narrower measure, which excludes tobacco, declined from 5.7% to 5.6%. Eurostat data showed that Latvia continued to struggle with the highest inflation at 15%, followed by Slovakia, Lithuania and Estonia, all dealing with a double-digit surge in consumer prices among the 20-member Eurozone. Inflation in the single currency area has been above the European Central Bank's ECB 2% target for nearly 2 years, with the regulator repeating hiking rates since last July to curb double-digit growth in consumer prices. The ECB once again increased rates recently to 3.25% and has promised another hike at its next meeting in June. Reuters also reported Eurozone inflation accelerated last month. Eurostat said recently, confirming preliminary data pointing to increasingly stubborn price growth among the 20 nations sharing the euro. Overall, price growth accelerated to 7% in April from 6.9% a month earlier, as rising services and energy costs offset a slowdown in food price growth. Although underlying price growth, the key focus of European Central Bank policymakers in recent months, slowed a touch, the crucial services component continued to accelerate, pointing to mounting wage pressures that could get inflation stuck above the ECB's 2% target. Excluding volatile food and fuel prices, core inflation slowed to 7.3% from 7.5%, while an even narrower measure, which excludes tobacco, slowed to 5.6% from 5.7% in its first decline since last June. Inflation has been above the ECB's 2% target for nearly 2 years, and the bank has lifted interest rates by a combined 375 basis points since last July to arrest runaway price growth. But more hikes are likely, as it could be 2025 before inflation is back at target, and the last mile of disinflation, getting from 3% to 2%, could be especially difficult, taking nearly 2 years. Reuters added services inflation, which is primarily driven by labor costs, accelerated to 5.2% from 5.1%, confirming policymaker fears that nominal wage growth could become dangerously fast. Wages are still down in real terms given rapid inflation, but low unemployment and growing labor scarcity, especially in services, is driving up nominal wages. The ECB has long said that nominal wage growth of 3% would be consistent with its inflation target, but this year's rise could be twice as fast. Unexpectedly generous wage deals in Germany, the bloc's biggest economy, also raised the risk that labor costs could continue to rise, especially quickly next year, prolonging inflation. Markets see the ECB's 3.25% deposit rate rising to just below 3.75% this summer, but some policymakers have already warned that this may not be enough.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues. Pakistan holding the US responsible for the delay in the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project, and also Iran and Pakistan inaugurating a border market and a power transmission line.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss Pakistan holds the U.S. responsible for the delay in the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. And we shall also take a look at Iran-Pakistan inaugurate border market and power transmission line.
Concerns have been raised by Pakistan's Public Accounts Committee over the payment of $18 billion in penalty if Islamabad fails to go ahead with the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. Slamming the hypocrisy of the United States, the chairman of the committee said that the penalty should be paid by the U.S. if it's not allowing Pakistan to proceed with the gas pipeline project with Iran. U.S. sanctions on Iran and pressure from Washington on Islamabad have been cited as the main reasons by Pakistan for the delay in the completion of the gas pipeline project.
The energy-starved South Asian Muslim country has recently blamed the U.S. for the delay in the completion of the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. Noor Alam Khan, head of the Public Accounts Committee, a transparency watchdog for all ministries and public agencies of Pakistan, said that the U.S. should pay the penalty if it does not approve of Pakistan and Iran going ahead with the gas pipeline project. He said that the United States of America will have to do away with its double standards. On the one hand, America is being lenient with India in meeting its energy needs, while on the other hand, it is punishing Pakistan for fulfilling its energy demands. Pakistan has been reiterating that it regards the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline important, especially in the emerging regional situation. According to the Foreign Ministry of Pakistan, Islamabad has been exploring all possible options, including close engagements and meaningful exchanges with relevant parties, especially Iran and the United States. The ministry further said that Pakistan is committed to the pipeline project. According to strategic relations experts, the gas supply Islamabad would receive from Tehran through the new pipeline would ease Pakistan's energy security woes considerably, and this should have provided enough motivation for Pakistan to complete the project. However, the ground reality is otherwise.
Pakistan roughly needs $3 billion to complete the construction of the pipeline on its side, which stretches over an area of 781 kilometers. The amount happens to be far less than the penalty of $18 billion it will have to pay if the project is not completed by early 2024. In recent months, the cash-strapped country has suffered a huge energy crisis, with European buyers hoarding liquefied natural gas at higher prices to overcome the loss of access to Russian oil. At this point, the energy trade between Iran and Pakistan can help solve Islamabad's worsening energy crisis.
The gas sales purchase agreement was signed between Iran and Pakistan in 2009. Iran completed its site of construction in 2011. However, even after 14 years, Islamabad has still not been able to complete the construction of the pipeline portion assigned to it. The pipeline was meant to be completed by December 2014. The first flow of gas from Iran to Pakistan was intended to start from early 2015. Pakistan has been reiterating that the failure from its side to complete the project within a stipulated time has been because of the difficulties caused by the U.S. pressure on Islamabad. According to foreign relations analysts, the unjustified U.S. sanction on Iran has created roadblocks for Islamabad to proceed with the construction of the gas pipeline. Holding the United States responsible for the delay in the completion of the project, the analysts say that America needs to revisit its foreign policy, as its faulty approach is damaging the faltering economies in the region. In an agreement signed between Interstate Gas Systems of Pakistan and the National Iranian Gas Company, Iran has agreed not to approach any international court if Pakistan completes the project by 2024. However, Islamabad's failure to build its infrastructure section will lead to a penalty of $18 billion for the South Asian Muslim country already battling with economic crisis.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by journalist and researcher Mr. Adnan Amir from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, let's talk about Pakistan blaming the U.S. for the delay in the gas pipeline project. Islamabad has said that the U.S. should be paying a penalty of $18 billion. Now, do you see the U.S. taking the responsibility of its misdeeds in the region?
No, I don't think that U.S. will take responsibility for its actions, because this current world order is dominated by the U.S. And whenever it sets sanctions on any country, it expects all the countries to abide by the sanctions. And if anybody does not follow those sanctions, then they are going to pay the price. So Pakistan itself is a very relatively economically weak country. It's dependent on the West. It's dependent on the Western monetary institutions such as IMF. So that's why Pakistan cannot afford to go against U.S. when it comes to sanctions. So Pakistan is paying the price, not only in the form of the penalty that it might have to pay to Iran, but also there is a severe shortage of gas in Pakistan, and there is no other way Pakistan can import it. It can easily get it from Iran, but because of the U.S. sanctions, Pakistan cannot get it. So now there is a growing realization in Pakistan that Pakistan should go ahead with this project and complete this Iran pipeline gas project. And the one way for doing it is that Pakistan asks U.S. to give it waiver, just like U.S. has given a waiver to India when it purchases oil from Iran.
Just like you mentioned, Mr. Amir, according to Islamabad, the U.S. has been lenient in its approach towards India's purchase of oil from Russia. So what can be the reason for this hypocrisy with regard to Pakistan?
I think now India perceives Pakistan and India in a very different way. Since 2006, U.S. is bracketed Pakistan with Afghanistan, and they consider India to be a regional power. And that's why, due to India's huge population and its economy, U.S. treats India in a favorable way. So if India wants something, if it wants to buy oil from Russia, then U.S. is always there to provide a waiver. And in the same way, because India is also purchasing oil from Iran, and the U.S. has also provided a bit of waiver. So I think the reason for having double standards for India and Pakistan is because Pakistan's economy is too small, and Pakistan does not matter, is not as important for U.S. as compared to India in terms of geostrategic terms, which is a double standard. But if we see on the global chessboard, that's how everything plays out, because every country is there to look after its interest. U.S. is looking after its interest when it's preferring India over Pakistan, and likewise, Pakistan should also look for its interest, and which is currently served by Pakistan imports gas from Iran.
Mr. Amir, $18 billion is a huge amount for a cash-starved country like Pakistan. So the question is, how is the country already under economic turmoil going to deal with the crisis situation?
Well, let's be clear about it. Pakistan is in no position to pay this penalty to Iran. Pakistan's foreign exchange reserves are just $4 billion, and there is a reduction on them. With the passage of every day, we can barely import, we can barely pay for 1 month of import. So there is no way Pakistan can pay this $18 billion damages to Iran. And I think that's one of the reasons that now the government of Pakistan has realized that they have to find a way to settle this matter with Iran, because they cannot pay this amount. So the same thing happened to Pakistan in the Recordic case, where there was an international arbitration. The TCC, Chittagong Convention, went to Special Court for Settlement of Investment in International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. And that ICSD gave a verdict in favor of that company, TCC. And Pakistan was asked to pay fines of around $7 billion. So there was no way Pakistan could pay them. So what the government of Pakistan did, they settled the matter out of court with the TCC, and they again allowed them to extract minerals from the Recordic project. So it's clear that if the Iran took this matter to arbitration next year, then Pakistan is in no position to pay the damages, and that's why it's a more feasible and it's more wise thing for the Pakistan to seriously consider working on this pipeline, constructing the pipeline in its territory, and ensuring that it abides by all the timelines based on the agreement that Pakistan has with Iran, so that this penalty can be averted.
And last but not least, due to its ongoing energy crisis, the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project holds great importance for Islamabad. So do you see Pakistan making any headways in the project?
Well, I think the government of Pakistan is seriously considering to start working on this project, because there are multiple reasons for it. First is, again, this $18 billion penalty that they have to pay, which they cannot pay. They have to avoid it. Secondly, there is a serious energy deficit in Pakistan, and there is no other supplier apart from Iran. So this is the only option that Pakistan has. And thirdly, I think because now Pakistan is moving a bit away from US and closer to China, and then there was this Saudi-Iranian rapprochement sponsored by China. So I think all these geostrategic reasons of this geostrategic chessboard that is taking place, it also favors Pakistan if it goes ahead with this deal. And the only problem is the U.S. sanctions, and Pakistan has to find a way around it. And I think just like Pakistan got a waiver from U.S. to purchase oil from Russia, I think in the same way, Pakistan, if it presses too hard, it might get a waiver from U.S. sanctions, and then it might be able to import gas from Iran, which is in the interest of Pakistan. And a few days back, the Pakistani Prime Minister and Iranian President met at Pak-Iran border area, where they inaugurated a market and 100 megawatt electricity supply that Iran is providing to Pakistan. So I think that's a good beginning, and the government of Pakistan would definitely want to build further on this, and they are really interested, and they are really making efforts to find a way so that this Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project can start.
On that note, I would like to thank journalist and researcher Mr. Adnan Amir from Islamabad for being on the program. Thank you, sir. Now let's see what people around the world had to say.
Aisha Khan tweeted, "Very positive and right step for struggling economy. Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline should also be completed without further delay." Dr. A. Kadir Memon wrote, $18 billion in penalty if the country did not go ahead with the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline project. Heather Mohataram tweeted, "Latest PAC logic, if Iran imposes a penalty for not completing Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline, then USA should pay it, since it is because of sanctions imposed on Iran." Pakistan wants the U.S. to respond if there is indeed any impact of U.S. sanctions in case Islamabad initiates the much-delayed Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Amidst a shared commitment to enhance economic cooperation, Pakistan and Iran have recently inaugurated the Mand Pishin Border Sustenance Marketplace. This new retail market, located in Mand town of Pakistan's Balochistan province and adjacent to Pishin city in Iran's Sisan and Balochistan province, marks a transformative step in bilateral trade between the two sides. Spanning across 10 acres of land, this marketplace holds immense potential for economic growth, fostering cross-border interactions and providing a platform with new avenues of opportunity for local businesses to thrive.
The historical ties between Pakistan and Iran have laid the foundation for this new chapter in economic cooperation. Mand, serving as a hub for small-scale border businesses, has been pivotal in connecting Balochistan's food and beverage industry to other districts and provinces of Pakistan. At the ceremony, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif emphasized the significance of this milestone, stating that it marks a new era in trade and business relations between the two brotherly countries. President Raisi, reaffirming Iran's commitment to enhancing ties with Pakistan, said that the country recognizes the Mand-Pishin border market as a valuable opportunity for economic growth and regional cooperation. He added that Iran considers the border with Pakistan as an opportunity rather than a threat, signaling a positive outlook towards fostering deeper economic collaboration between the two sides. The market scope includes a diverse range of foods spanning from agricultural products, textiles, handicrafts to household items. Economic analysts say that this increased economic activity will not only benefit local businesses but also contribute to the overall economic development of the border regions. Beyond economic significance, this market also acts as a physical manifestation of the long-standing connection between the two neighbors, promoting cultural exchange and fostering a sense of shared heritage.
In another significant display of regional cooperation, Iran and Pakistan have jointly inaugurated the Poland-Gap electricity transmission line alongside the Mand-Pishin border market. This transmission line, which spans across the border, is designed to carry an additional 100 megawatts of electricity from Iran to Pakistan, supplementing the existing 132 kilovolts Macron Division electricity transmission line. This collaboration aims to meet the energy requirements of households and businesses in Balochistan, having a significant impact on this energy-strapped region's development.
Poland, located in Sistan Balochistan's port city of Chabahar, serves as the starting point of this transmission line, while Gap, situated on the Pakistani side, lies 87 kilometers from Gwadar, a crucial road in the multi-billion dollar China-Pakistan Economic Corridor project. This strategic location of the transmission line holds immense potential for regional connectivity and economic growth. The electricity transmission line was inaugurated alongside the Mand-Pishin border market, highlighting the comprehensive nature of Pakistan-Iran cooperation. While the border market serves as a vibrant hub for trade and economic activities, the electricity transmission line reinforces the energy infrastructure, ensuring the efficient transmission of electricity between the two countries. During the joint inauguration ceremony, Pakistan's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif stressed on the significance of this energy collaboration, terming these projects as emblematic of the vitality of Pakistan-Iran friendship. He reiterated the commitment to strengthen bilateral ties and expand cooperation in the energy sector. He also emphasized Islamabad's intention to negotiate the signing of a free trade agreement with Tehran, aiming to unlock new horizons of trade and foster greater economic integration. According to foreign affairs analysts, the establishment of the market and the inauguration of the transmission line mark significant milestones in the journey of Iran and Pakistan towards deeper economic cooperation.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by journalist, writer, talk show host, and columnist Mr. Farooq Khan Pitafi from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, with the establishment of border markets along the Iran-Pakistan border, what will be the future trajectory of cross-border trade and economic growth in the region?
Right. Regarding the bilateral trade, the trajectory is going to be upward. It is important to remember that Balochistan, especially the province that is adjacent to Iran, constitutes somewhere around 44% of Pakistani territorial landmass. So there are areas which are not covered by Pakistan's domestic market, especially Makran area and the border areas with Iran. For starters, it is going to bring, upward economic movement in those areas, especially because the terrain in Makran region is really, really, infertile. That is why we have to import a lot of, goods and services from other areas. I think that this will provide the local population the local solutions which are next door to them. This is for starters. But later on, I think that given the paltry trade volume between the two countries, which are actually juxtaposed and which are neighbors, right? Quite a long border they have. So I think that in coming days, it is going to improve the bilateral trade and regional trade quite effectively.
Mr. Pitafi, to what extent has the Poland-Gap electricity transmission line addressed the energy needs of Balochistan, and what is its potential contribution to the overall economic development of the region?
Right. Regarding the regional cooperation in energy, it is very crucial, especially because, as I pointed out, that these areas, especially the Makran belt and the areas adjacent to Gwadar, are not that much accessible to Pakistan's infrastructure. The biggest problem recently when I visited Gwadar was electricity. We are already importing somewhere around 104 megawatt of electricity from Iran, because the Pakistani grid is still 100 kilometers away from Gwadar. So the biggest problem there was, especially because the water table is down as well, it is, very deep, and you have to dig a lot to get water. Similarly, other amenities are also linked with electricity. The fact that Pakistan could not provide electricity to Gwadar was a humongous problem. So now, with the inauguration of this new transmission line, the total import of electricity goes north of 200 megawatt, which is great, especially because even only in Gwadar itself, the consumption need is at least 150 megawatts.
Mr. Patafi, in terms of regional stability, what role does the Poland Gap electricity transmission line play in fostering greater cooperation between Pakistan and Iran?
Well, Pakistan and Iran are two peas in a pod. They are culturally interlinked that their border areas, these areas that we are talking about, on Pakistani side, it is called Balochistan, and I told you how big part of Pakistan this territory is. Similarly, in Iran also, it is called Balochistan, Wasistan. So we have so much in common. And when you look at the numbers of trade volume, the most frustrating part was that it has never gone upward of $3 billion. At this moment, I think it is below $1 billion. So the first thing that is important is whenever you're trading, whenever you're working together, it brings prosperity to these regions, and that ensures that the resentment or the complaints or the lack of satisfaction in the local masses actually goes away. This is very important because I can't say about Iranian region, but I can talk about our region. I'm an ethnic Baloch, and I can tell you how much there's this feeling that this region has not prospered benefited from the Pakistani story.
And last but not least, Mr. Patafi, how do you see the Manpishin border market contributing to the overall economic integration and regional cooperation between Pakistan and Iran?
Before government change in Afghanistan, there was talk of cooperation border towns between Afghanistan and Pakistan, which could actually ensure that there is some kind of cooperation there, and there can be collective production of goods and services. Although that changed with whatever happened in Afghanistan. With Iran, we have better circumstances because the border is stable, because both countries can work together. And this is one start. There are going to be six similar markets, right? This is only one of them. So in coming days, I'm hoping that we can actually bring together cooperation to such an extent that Pakistan, Iran, can produce together. They can also provide to each other whatever goods and services that are needed. I hear that Pakistani mangoes are very popular in Iran, and Iran imports a significant part of that from Pakistan. Similarly, there was a time I'm told that our basmati rice was also imported from Pakistan. These are unfinished goods. These are essentially commodities. But when we start working with value addition, and when we can actually produce the things that are needed by the other side, I think that the potential of such markets is infinite. It is going to bring the countries together. Our hearts are already together.
There you have it, journalist, writer, talk show host and columnist Mr. Farooq Khan Patafi from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see what people have to say on social media.
Sajjad Nusrati tweeted, After the numerous agreements between Iran and Russia in the past days, it was Pakistan's turn today. Iran and Pakistan opened a joint border market today. Pakistan Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif said that Iran-Pakistan trade will reach $5 billion. Dania Wahid tweeted, "The Mand-Pishin joint border market is a symbol of the flourishing trade ties between Pakistan and Iran. Today's meeting between PM Shehbaz Sharif and President Ibrahim Raisi highlights the commitment to further strengthen economic cooperation." Ehsan Zafar Bakhtawari tweeted, "The resumption of border trade between Pakistan and Iran is great news for Pakistan's troubled economy. The establishment of border market will create employment opportunities on both sides. This step from both governments has long-term consequences. The work on Pak Iran." Akhtar Rana tweeted, "Marketplace is the first of six to be constructed along the Pakistan-Iran border under a 2012 agreement signed by the two sides. Top leaders of Pakistan, Iran inaugurate border market in their first meeting in 10 years.
And that was our episode on the Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline delay because of the defective US policies and a new chapter in the Iran-Pakistan trade through the opening of a border market and electricity transmission line. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
In the limelight. In Louisiana, United States, racial discrimination and fear are putting women's and babies' lives at risk. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. A Louisiana hospital sent a mom home with prayers while